Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. It's Thanksgiving week. It's the 22nd. We should be talking about Thanksgiving. This should be our Thanksgiving episode, but it's not going to be.
We usually have a very special
Preventing Grace podcast.
In which we, what do we do on Thanksgiving? We talk about food, right?
Mm-hmm. But we're not going to do
and
that
then
now.
Right, things we're thankful for. But we're not going to do that.
We don't.
We're going to transfer Thanksgiving to next Monday.
Really?
Well, our Thanksgiving podcast. Maybe we can do.
Is it a movie?
Maybe we can do
podcast?
A podcast recap of Thanksgiving.
I mean, you don't have. Maybe at the end, will you give like reiterate your tips for a good turkey?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Maybe we'll do that.
But
if we have time.
Now we're gonna just talk about more about how bad things are because well you found this podcast.
Yeah, the bishop of the churches for the sake of others, the diocese of the churches for the sake of others, the diocese of the churches for the sake of others, Bishop Todd Hunter has set up a new a center for formation, justice, and peace, or something along those lines. And you know, in this center, he's promoting a lot of critical race theorists and deconstructionists, people who want.
Well, there's only two episodes.
Hmm?
Oh, the center.
In the center, right.
The center.
People who want to supplant theology and exegesis with ideology, leftist ideology. And of course, Kristen Dumais is one of the chief actors or actresses in that kind of drama. And in one of the videos that he has put together to promote the center and
he has a podcast.
Yeah, he's a podcast. And well, in this video, he has he along with his co-host has Kristen Dumais as his guest, and they're talking about her book, her ideas about men and women in the church. If you haven't read her book, you might want to read it, but read it with caution because it's not a good sound. It's heterodox in its understanding of the Christian faith, and has done a really good review of it that was posted in the. Well, how long ago was that? That was a week. Or a year ago? Or...
I don't know how long it was, but it wasn't well received.
Well, no, not by the deconstructionists it wasn't, but it was a great review. It was well received by others, but not by Kristen Dumais, of course. She didn't like what you said. But, you know, in this center, that's from the reading material that he promotes, Bishop Hunter promotes, is people like James Cone, who is, if you read his work, denies the efficacy of the substitutionary efficacy of the atonement. He denies, essentially, white people have to become repentant of their whiteness in order to be saved, in his one understanding of a Christian faith. And he's a heretic, is the way I would put it. And a bishop in the ACNA is promoting him, which is a dangerous thing, I think. And so, a very sad thing. And so, anyway, we thought we'd go through this. We thought we'd listen to this interview with Kristen Dumais and point out some things that she believes and why we don't think it's proper and appropriate for her to be promoted in the church. She's a professor at Calvin College, by the way. Calvin College has taken a leftward leap recently. I guess not so recently. It's been headed in that direction.
I don't know anything about it, really.
Well, there was an incident earlier, like last year, I think, when two
That's right.
Christian students set up a table on campus to
promote
Christian orthodoxy, sexual orthodoxy, right? But basically, the table had the Bible passages that deal with sex and homosexuality front and center, and a mob of LGBTQ students mobbed them. James K. Smith, in support of the mob, decided to come out with a pro-trans shirt and posted on, took a picture of himself in this pro-trans shirt and posted it on Twitter, and Kristen DeMay was all in support of him and just how wonderful he is. And then she was, and she also was, if you look at her Twitter feed, she doesn't think that non-gay historians are going to be able to provide a real history of the, or she's very much a standpoint
person.
Someone who doesn't believe, you're not a woman, you're not black, you're not minority, you're not LGBTQ, you can't really do history in an objective way.
Well, in this interview, she says no historian is objective.
Right.
And we're not even, no one's even trying to be.
And there's some truth to that. I mean, we all have our own places, but the question isn't whether or not whether historians come to a question with their own biases. It's a question of whether or not these biases so damage their capacity to tell a story or to recount a narrative that there is no actual truth out there, just stories that we tell. And that's the deconstructionist idea, that it's beyond, you cannot transcend your standpoint. And that destroys history, that destroys exegesis, that destroys
everything. Really.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's very discouraging. I thought the interview was really interesting, and I guess we should listen to it instead of me starting in on all my thoughts and feelings. but should we do that?
Yes.
I really, really, especially like the opening music. Actually, I was. Oh, did you skip the opening?
No, I didn't mean to.
I think it's worth it just for the opening music. And I don't think we should put it too close, because then we're going to be like, it's going to be a lot louder than us. The music is so great.
As long as you're always there, our opening music is
great. Wait, you keep... No.
Oops.
Oh, man, we're doing the opening music. We're not technically... You should turn it down just a bit. So, because it's louder than us. There.
This really is almost as well done as ours. You can see.
How are you when you stop it and start it? You're gonna be jumping back and forth.
Hey everyone, this is Peace Talks, where we have brave conversations with leading activists who are doing the work of pursuing justice and peace in the midst of.
Wait. Brave conversations.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that for a minute?
I mean, we're already having a brave conversation. Yeah,
this is already, you know, putting someone who is speaking for the popular side, the side that has the power right now, which is the progressive side. Another one of those, you know, someone writes an article saying, you know, racism is bad, and it's a brave article. No, it's not brave. One is obvious. Two,
it could be a truthful article. It could be as in, like, racism is seriously so bad.
Right, right. But then
stop being racist.
Right, but then saying, you know, writing an article saying all white evangelicals are racist. That's not brave. That you're going to get accolades for that. You can probably get a publisher and write a book for that.
It's not a brave
conversation.
The LGBTQ thing isn't brave right now either. Like, it's not brave.
Yeah,
it's just to come out.
No, I mean, it's that's you that you want to win instant adulation.
It's actually the most sensible thing you can do is
come out
trans. If you're,
yeah,
like if you're bullied or you know, and you don't have a community and you're isolated, the best way to achieve cultural acclaim and community is to become trans.
Yeah.
I mean, I have firsthand evidence of that.
That's, yeah. and then criticize white males. White male image.
Well, I don't think all the people, all the young people who are becoming trans are not, like, some of them are.
No, but I'm saying that's how you become famous. You gain fame and adulation.
If you want acceptance, become trans. If you want adulation, complain about Christianity.
Right.
Okay, go on. Sorry.
Oh, that is groaning. These are well-formed men and women who are inspirational to us, and we hope they will be for you as well. My name is Vanessa Sadler. I'm here with Bishop Todd Hunter.
I do want to complain about the word well. well-formed, like the wellness industry has come in. A question of being well. It isn't exactly a Christian thing. In fact, I think what the Bible would say was healthy or well would look very contrary to what anything in the world would say, really.
Yeah.
Like, Christians have full-on adopted the wellness language uncritically without measuring it against Scripture. And so wellness and flourishing go together to mean something that the Bible just doesn't accept. So anytime you hear well-formed or well or flourishing, you should just chuck it.
Well, or see who's saying.
Who's saying.
Who is using that language. And sometimes it can be used.
I mean, if you were going to look for well in Paul's life, he was always being beaten and left for dead. So what do you mean by well-formed? Also, he like wanted everyone just to be obedient and stop sinning, but that never worked out.
Todd, it's so good to be with you.
It's good to be with you too. You're a fun partner to have.
Today we have the pleasure of speaking to Kristen Cobez-DeMay. I'm excited about the perspective she brings as an historian to the conversation on Christian nationalism and militant masculinity in the church.
So Christian nationalism is the catch-all term that is being used to describe conservative evangelicals, people, evangelicals who trust the authority of Scripture and who have are not leftist, right? So
yeah, so you don't have to have a flag in your sanctuary.
Nope.
You can like never sing the national anthem. You cannot even like have never read a QAnon website. But because you believe in traditional marriage, you're a Christian nationalist.
Right. Or if you voted for Trump. Yeah, it doesn't matter why you voted for Trump. So I remember when the key reason why we are all militant masculinists and Christian nationalists is because the key identifier is if you voted for Trump. And it doesn't matter why. You can say, I voted for Trump because I was afraid I wanted to protect the life of unborn children.
I didn't like Hillary Clinton.
Or I didn't like Hillary Clinton. Or I didn't like Joe Biden, whatever it might be. It doesn't matter. But the real reason you voted for Trump is because you
are a Christian nationalist.
You're a Christian nationalist.
But also, you don't have to have voted for Trump. You could also really, really, really dislike Trump. You could think that Trump was like, you know, not great for America, blah, 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 but not think that he was so wicked that he was literally Hitler. Just by thinking that Trump wasn't literally Hitler, or that some people voted him had good motivations, and you're still a Christian nationalist.
Or if you're a complementarian.
You know what it is? It's like that guy.
Yeah.
Jail.
Right.
Jail. You still go jail.
Right. So there is a group, and we've talked about it before in this podcast. There are a group, and it is usually the far extreme side of Pentecostalism that began to see President Trump as you know, the new Cyrus, who had this kind of prophetic view of Trump. Is on that side of things, there is a real wedding between between populist right wing politics and religion, that is very sick. I mean, that's absolutely true. But there's an attempt now to say that's everybody. That's
yeah.
It's within that wing of Pentecostalism that you had the January 6th thing going on. It wasn't most evangelicals who voted for Trump just because of pro-life issues or whatever. But there's an attempt to say everybody, all evangelicals who are not woke, fall into that.
Christian nationalists.
Or have the same ideas that group did.
I just do find it so bad, so dangerous to write off all Christians who voted for Trump.
Right.
Like, I know we're a year out from it now, but it's still the narrative, and that's
yeah.
I mean, you should never write off half of the population. I know.
Isn't Christian, DeMay's I knew some like in her Christian, book just trying to explain why Christians voted for Trump,
yeah.
And it was mostly masculinism and Christian.
Yeah, I mean there were in the previous. Under the previous president, there were Christians who did that to Democrats. I heard, like, there were people on the right who just swept away everybody on the left and said they are all, quote, like this.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who loved or voted for Obama was like this. Mm-hmm. And as if this is a huge monolith. And that wasn't good then. That wasn't a good thing to do. And it's still not a good thing to do. Okay.
So one last thing, notice how it's assumed, though, is that it's these ideologies, Christian nationalism and militant masculinism, are just described that offhandedly as if they're assumed to be characteristic of a wide swath of people.
They're just true.
They're just there, right.
Jerry focuses on the intersection of gender, religion, and politics in recent American history. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation.
The subtitle itself is slanderous, White Evangelicals. You know, it's just, that encompasses literally millions of people and makes sweeping generalizations and characterizations of them. It's very uncharitable and it's unchristian, and I don't see how she has the platform that she has, except for the fact that she's I don't see how.
Well, I think people want this to be true. I think Christians want this to be true. Like they want to take responsibility for something, but they don't want to. This is the same kind of thing as in Episcopalianism, where you're repenting for the sins committed on your behalf. Like, you don't really think of yourself as a white nationalist. Of course, that if you're an evangelical, that really doesn't, you know, DeMay is a white evangelical, but she's not part of this group that she's describing, even though she is a white evangelical. But you do want it to be true because you want to be absolved in some way. You want to get off the hook, but you don't want to actually look at the sins that you are actually committing of hatred towards other people.
Self-righteousness.
Conversation with Kristen, we really seek to find the parallels between history and spiritual formation, specifically attempting to learn from the instances in history that we prefer not to repeat. Let the conversation begin.
Let's find Kristen.
I love their set.
Hey, Kristen, great to have you today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Kristen, we're going to go ahead and jump right in. I would love for you to share a little bit with our listeners about your primary focus of research. When we talk about the Center for Formation, Justice, and Peace, it might not come intuitively, the links between the work that you do and justice and peace. And so we would love for you to talk about sort of the implications that you've come across in issues of power and gender. And
we should say, you know, the justice is not justice. When they say the Center for the Formation of Justice and Peace, justice here is not being used in its biblical sense. It's being used in its ideological sense. So, and you can hear her start to go this way, because, but what what it tends to be meant by that word justice is seeing through every disparity, every social disparity, and spotting the power binary there, who has power, who doesn't, and then taking that power binary as the cause of the disparity. So the reason why the reason why the ACNA doesn't have a minority makeup that matches the minority makeup of the nation is because racism. It's because there must be some inherent racist way of thinking and doing the church and being the church that prevents us from being diverse. And there's no need to do the analysis to find out why the disparity exists, because the disparity exists ideologically because of this power imbalance. And doing justice is repairing that, giving power to others, and thereby that will correct this this imbalance. So actively, we're actually trying to push forward people regardless of merit into positions to make it more diverse or whatever, that's going to solve the diversity problem. And
justice problem.
The justice problem, right. So that's not biblical justice. Biblical justice is impartiality. It's actually something that most the people promoting quote-unquote justice today hate, and that's colorblindness. It's not looking at the color of someone's skin, someone's sex, someone's background, but assessing a case, and for example, in the law court, on the basis of the merits of the evidence, what is it that happens, not who is it that who is not looking first at who the person is, but what the question is, and studying and answering the question again on the basis of evidence and things of that sort. But that's not what they mean by justice. In fact, justice is partial. It's always partial to the poor and the people they believe to be powerless.
Patriarchy. And then maybe a little bit of your own story,
the word patriarchy.
How it led you to this kind of work.
Yeah,
sure.
It'll come
sure.
back up, I'm sure.
So I'll start with my own story, actually. And I grew up in a Christian home. In the Reformed tradition, I went to Christian schools, went to a Christian college, and had always been deeply interested in history. And then I went off to graduate school to study the history that I thought mattered most. And in my tradition, it was quite clear that was religious and intellectual history. So I went off to the University of Notre Dame to study religious and intellectual history. And my first semester there, I was introduced to the study of gender in history. And a professor shared a book on the history of women and gender and race and power, and my mind was blown. And I immediately...
Okay, so if you have taken any gender study course...
And this is why we're like, after spending so much money on our kids' education through high school... Like, it's a little terrifying to send them into the academy and think, oh, University of Notre Dame, this is going to be so prestigious and awesome. And then they come out and they're like, oh, no, man, I'm writing Jesus and John Wayne now. Yeah. Like, you're the wrong one. Like, everything that you did to form me as a Christian is bad. Right. And I am going to blow all of it up. I mean, that is so disappointing. Yeah.
So traditionally, history is the question of it examines the question of what happened and why. So let's go back into the study of the data, the records of World War II, whatever, and write a comprehensive account, a narrative account, maybe, of what happened, and the causes for it. Ideological analysis of history is a different thing. So you have an idea, say that women have always been abused and dominated by men, and that needs to be undone. And so you go through history with that idea, that lens, and you find examples of it. You build a case, basically. It's this idea, ideologically grounded history, it goes all the way back, especially in the left, to you know, of course, he wasn't the first, but Marx was really, you know, accomplished at it. So he would, he, one of his famous essays was examining the revolutionary government of Napoleon, not the Napoleon, but his, I think it's Napoleon.
How many Napoleons were
there?
No,
his grandson or something like that. I forgot who it was. Like... It, but yeah, it's 1848. The 18th premier. So, anyway, and Marx wasn't doing history. He knew he wasn't doing history. He was doing a revolutionary analysis of the event, of the account, and taking his own assumptions, his own philosophical assumptions about economics and the way those play into history, and now analyzing the event in those terms. And that's what gender studies does. It takes an ideological given about men and women, and then analyzes historical events, history in accordance with that ideological given. You know, it's not history. I mean, people always say, well, Christian DeMay and Alison Barr, they're just historians. No, they're not historians. They're ideologues.
It's so interesting to me that I don't know how old she is, but I tried to take literature at Cornell, you know, French and English literature, and I ended up in literary theory, critical theory, queer theory, all the theories in the 90s, and gender.
Was your mind blown?
No, I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was funny. Like, I thought it was so dumb. It was funny, and it was an interesting thing to do, like go back and read, you know, Jane Austen with a feminist queer lens. But like, that's obviously stupid, and that ruins Jane Austen. You know, if you're going to go back and read Oscar Wilde books, obviously, I mean, Oscar Wilde is super gay, and you can find lots of gay stuff in Oscar Wilde and underneath the surface. And so that was, I mean, I took decadence. I took a class on literary decadence, and if you're looking for gender studies, it's like ramps that up by another degree. And it was an interesting and fun class, but it was really bad. And I mean, like, it didn't occur to me to think, you know what, now I'm going to reorder my entire Christian faith based on this secularist, God-hating person who has had her mind blown. But like, it obviously she's not well. That's what I thought about all my professors. None of these people are well. And so, yeah, I just think that's interesting. I mean, like, I was introduced to all this stuff probably in the same time period, but
you weren't,
it's not a given that you have to become Kristen Coburn's DeMay.
So it's interesting. I do notice, and I'm not sort of saying she's like this, but I do notice that there's a certain type of person who goes into college or goes to graduate school experience and just without critically examining what they're being taught and just kind of takes it as a given.
I think, and then
they take it and then they say, well, now I'm educated. I did see the world this way. My professors taught me to see the world this way. And now I'm educated without any kind of critical interrogation of what they've been taught by their professors.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, because I also grew up in a Christian household, in a Christian school, in a Christian, like, uber Christian, ramped up missionary culture. I've been thinking about this because I'm also reading Rachel Held Evans' posthumous book, and she has the same story. I was in Christian home, and I went to a Christian school and a Christian college, and then I discovered the truth, which is that it was all bunk. And I'm not going to give up my Christianity. I'm going to redefine Christianity now. Right. But that's not... In the crisis of the young person, in the death of evangelicalism in America, I do think, as you're sending your children to college, you have to give them something to push against.
Right.
And it should have been the culture.
Yeah.
It should have been secularism. It shouldn't have been the church.
Right.
And I mean, I'm seeing that over and over and over again. The intellectuals on the right are people who are embarrassed about having been Christian. They didn't have anything as Christians, as young Christians, to battle down. No. There was no.
Or they may have, but now they see that they shouldn't. They were on the wrong side. They were raised in a very fundamentalist household.
She's not, like, not really. I mean, in many cases, these, quote, fundamentalist household were very reasonable, normal.
But that's
Christians.
How they're going to see it.
Though. Yeah. So they're like
rebelling against their past.
Slander. So, yeah. You have to rebel against something. As you're bringing up your children, you should consider what is it that exactly that you want them to rebel against? Not that you can pick that necessarily or anticipate that, but, you could at least pray to God that they will find a foe that's not you.
That's also God's foe.
That's also God's foe.
Not so. And when one institution that's not God's foe is the church.
Yeah.
So if your instinct after coming back from college is to attack the bride of Christ,
it may be that
you point out
your parents have
and to destroy her
wasted $100,000.
Yeah. So
immediately that week changed my focus and picked up a field in the study of women and gender, and I really haven't looked back because I realized, wait, this is the history that really matters. Right, this is the history. It does matter in so many ways, and it certainly in my own upbringing in a conservative Christian community, gender had always really been reduced to the issue of should women be ordained as ministers or not. And that was about what it was limited to and what I understood in history. It's about so much more. And it's intertwined with racial identity. It's intertwined with class and with power and all these kind of buzzwords. But I saw it as...
Yeah, that's ideology there. So that she... What intertwines it is the power binary. Is it in each who has power, who doesn't? The oppressor oppressed binary. That's the intertwining that she's talking about. We might refer to it as intersectionality. I mean, that same boundary, that same relationship is where intersectionality gets its power. How many statuses do you have? Are you white? That's a mark against you, but you're a woman. Okay, that's great. Are you lesbian? Oh, even better. Are you, are you not Christian? That's even better. So,
historian, right? In how really it was just about people's lives, and it was about how this world worked, and for me as a Christian, and as a Calvinist, who had always been told about sin and about how we as humans are fallen, total depravity. And it's not just human sinfulness, but our structures, our institutions, our societies also reflect that human fallenness, and that we are called to seek shalom, and we are called to redeem.
All right, let's talk about this for a second.
We're never going to get through this.
I know.
We're going to have to do like 10 parts on this.
So this is one. This is a classic one. So yes, we'll take the Calvinist doctrine of total depravity, which, by the way, most of the people talking about total depravity now wouldn't have liked the idea had it not for themselves fit so nicely into their ideology.
Yeah, I didn't hear a lot of like rejoicing over
Calvinism.
Over Tulip before this year.
Right.
Honestly.
Right. But so what total depravity means is that every faculty of the human person has been marred and twisted by sin, so that you're not able to attain to God on your own, by your own efforts, because your mind, your heart, your will, all of that is turned inward toward yourself. It doesn't mean that we can't, it doesn't mean that by common grace we can't understand what fairness is, we can't understand what justice is, we can't understand the law of God. In fact, the law of God is written on every heart, so that's why we have a conscience, that's why we feel guilty about things. It doesn't mean we can't make discoveries. It does mean, with relationship to God, the human person is unable, because the human person is unwilling to submit and seek Him. That what total depravity does not mean is that in every possible way we're all we've all sinned. So I remember being in a discussion with another ACNA clergywoman about this. And she said, well, because we're all totally depraved, then you can't, then we're certainly all racist. Well, no. It's like that's like saying, because we're all totally depraved, we're all pedophiles. Just because we're all sinners doesn't mean we all sin in the very same way. There are some people are not racists. That's possible, even in a totally depraved world. Not every institution has succumbed to racism or patriarchy or whatever, or the sinful patriarchy. To say that a structure has become corrupted by racism is fine if you can actually, using biblical categories, study the structure, study the system, study the institution, and see, yes, okay, there's sinful partiality here that needs to be dealt with. Otherwise, you can't just say, because we're all fallen, and because there's maybe racism, there is racism in America's past, all of its structures are therefore racist and misogynist, which is the leap that people tend to take on the progressive side. Oh, there's a bunter.
Of gender and race and power absolutely are part of that understanding the fallenness of human society and understanding what we can do to bring things more in alignment with God's will for human flourishing. So I've always understood my research into.
I mean, I don't want to. That's not the task of the Christian, is to bring the world into God's alignment with human flourishing or whatever. Like, that's not the call of the gospel. I think from. As we go through this, and as I listened to the whole thing, I was really unhappy that it's not just that the categories being used about men and women are from intersectionality or feminism, or that there's a hermeneutic of deconstructive doubt or something like that. It's that the posture towards the entire cosmos has shifted away from one that I recognize as a Christian. I think, like, this is where I feel utterly gaslighted. That's not the job. That's not what Christians are called to do, is bring the world into alignment with human flourishing. What is that? That is a very nebulous,
right,
completely made up and unmeasurable thing that is human-centered. It has nothing to do with God.
What it tends to mean, though, is ending all disparity. So our complementarians are unjust because there's a disparity between the role of a woman or a role of a man that needs to be brought into alignment so that human beings can flourish. It tends to mean that any kind of disparity needs to be undone. So remember, the justice is not ensuring an equality of outcome. Justice is, in biblical terms, is ensuring a fair process that enables people, regardless of their color or their sex, to achieve, right? But it doesn't mean that they'll all achieve at the same levels, they'll all get the same things, they'll all be in the same positions. We can't guarantee that justly.
I mean, the aesthetics of this, too, are inhuman.
Right.
Like, forcing the world to come into alignment with human flourishing. With
your understanding of human flourishing.
What you will end up with is, the brutalism appreciation society writ large.
Right.
Like,
it's ugly, yeah.
It is really, it is full of hubris. Is that the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, right.
And human pride. It takes to the human person the task that God is able to accomplish without
our
help.
It's a utopian task. You're building utopia. And then that's the task of that's the Marxist idea. This is why people call this type of thinking cultural Marxism, because it takes, it has the same kind of paradigm where you see the power or the oppressor binary, needs to ultimately be overcome in history by revolutionary action, and all disparities undone, and then you have utopian peace, and that's done by an exertion of power of some kind.
I mean, this is the point at which I wish Christians listening to this would be like, oh, well, this person's not talking about the Bible or Christianity. So as a Christian, I'm going to go listen to something else. Right. I'm not going to involve myself with the Center of Peace and Justice because this is neither peaceful nor just. And
right.
I'm not going to listen to this. What Jesus wants us to do, which is to go into all the world and make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and which is a God-oriented and God-directed task, is contrary to this one. And so I'm going to go do something else now. That's what I wish would happen more and more and more as people listen to this stuff.
I mean, this is very militant. I mean, she was introduced as someone who's investigating militant masculinity. This is a very militant movement. It's militant femininity. Militant
toxic femininity.
Yeah, I mean, really, let's undo the powers. Let's take down the towers and the city and build it back as we wish in our own image. But it's couched in language that's about peace and justice. It's not about peace. It's about militancy, and it's not about justice. It's about injustice, and creating some utopian vision. Or bringing about utopia by our own efforts.
History of gender, it very much aligned with my own upbringing in a conservative Calvinist space, actually. I don't know that all would agree, but that's my backstory. And I've then continued that research. My first book was on the history of Christian feminism, where I came to see that, you know, throughout Christian history, and for me as an Americanist, throughout American history, there have been, you know, devout, otherwise conservative Christians who read the scriptures in a way that that undermines patriarchy, that sees that God's will for women and for men is not a patriarchal rule. It is liberation. And just knowing that that was an interpretive possibility, I think, freed me up personally.
So the part of her and Beth Arlton Barr's book is this idea that the role differential between men and women is not grounded in creation. It's not part of the creation story. And so when God created marriage, when he brought Adam and Eve together, that was a fully egalitarian relationship. And that reading it any other way is patriarchy. And anybody who lives out their, any church or family who lives out their life in a what we would call complementarian way is promoting a fallen way of life. We would read Genesis 2 in light of Matthew 19 and Ephesians 5. So in Matthew 19, Jesus says or indicates that God created male and female for the purpose of bringing them together in marriage. And that first marriage between Adam and Eve was constitutive of every marriage. That was what every marriage is about. And then in Ephesians 5, verses 31 to 33, Paul quotes chapter 2, verse 24. This is before the fall, when God says, therefore, a man should leave his father's house and his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Paul takes that text, which Jesus said is about every marriage, and says that refers to Christ and his church. So in other words, that first marriage in the garden, which is constitutive of every marriage, is also a picture of Jesus and his relationship to his church. In fact, marriage is created for that purpose, to make that picture. And the question we have to ask ourselves is the relationship between Jesus and his church egalitarian? And no, it's not. and that's why Paul says to women, submit to your husbands, and as to the Lord, and husbands, love your wives as the Lord loves his church. And he's not grounding that on a fallen system. He's grounding that in Genesis 2, before the fall. The chief promoter of quote unquote patriarchy in the church is God himself, who happens to be a patriarch. So,
that's the biblical thing that we're, I'm interested by how much in all of, well, Beth Allis and Barr dealt with the Bible to one degree or another, not very effectively, but, what I don't like about the egalitarian way of being, I'm having too many thoughts going in my head at one time. So until, 2 years ago, I did really have a hard time with the label complementarian. I didn't want to use either complementarian or egalitarian. And I resisted that a lot. I still think like it's a forced binary. It's forcing a category that we have now back onto the scriptures that it's a really bad way of looking at the Bible, looking for how we can get more, you know, like the egalitarian seems to go to the scripture and with this idea of, well, what can I get? Like, how much can I do? How equal am I? Rather than, I really want to know who God is. Right. I really want to understand what Christ and the church is about. I want to know how God loves the world. I'm interested in who God is. And then, of course, women and men are fascinating. And so if you want to call it complementarian, here's what they are. They're different from each other. Like,
and they have different roles.
They have different desires
and designs.
They have different ends to want to some degree. And so, it's true that men and women
corresponds to God's creation. I know the picture of the church and Jesus.
In some sense, it's true that men and women are equal,
of course,
with each other. Like
in being, like
they are part of the human family. God created them together in his image, not so that one could lord it over the other or flatten the other one out,
right.
But he did create them to be different from each other. I feel really stupid having to say this out loud.
Right. But well, there is a cursed form of patriarchy. I mean, where the men dominate and tyrannize women rather than...
But also, what by saying, when she uses the word complementarian, it's a smear against all people who think that men and women are different and that women's biological realities matter. What's the acronym for that? That people who think that marriage could look similar across the ages without it being abusive, that the order of the church matters.
Mm-hmm.
That all those people are Christian nationalists. You know, they're all duped. If they're women, they're being abused without knowing it.
Right.
And I don't accept that. I think that, again, the way this is being cast and the words complementarian and egalitarian I don't know about the way complementarians use it, but if you hear an egalitarian talking about complementarianism, you can probably be sure not everyone, but many of them are not interested in who God is, a theology of God and his will in the world.
You see it not everyone does this, but you see it in the way they go back through the scriptures and strip mine accounts of women in the scriptures and twist them like so you can't have a woman who really sinned greatly if you're an ideologue. So you have to valorize the sex work of Rahab in some way. So she was probably abused, and if she was a prostitute.
I mean, I saw that on Twitter this week. Like, people were actually,
You can't, and so Bathsheba was all, certainly she was raped, even though two chapters after the account of Bathsheba and David.
There is a horrible rape,
and the author describes it as such, and he doesn't do the same with Bathsheba. You have to go through and find every woman who might be accused of sin, like Tamar, who seduced Judah. It was, that was a good thing. She was justified in doing that. You can't say this woman sinned greatly and look at the mercy of God forgiving her and saving her, just like he saves the sinful men. It's because you're not looking for that. You're looking for heroes, the hero story. And so Beth Allison Barr, in her book, ends up saying the Canaanite woman won an argument with Jesus. The woman who was asking Jesus to heal her daughter or cast a demon out of her daughter. And Jesus was not being taught by her or instructed by her.
He wasn't a racist. You can't go to the text and say, where was Jesus a racist in the text? Which is what you end up with if you want to say that the Syrophoenician woman or whatever was like
Jesus's teacher.
Won
the argument. Yeah.
That,
which even the text itself gives you plenty of hints, both in the context of the account and the account itself, that no, Jesus wasn't being taught by her or being argued down by her. He was using her to illustrate to his disciples that, Gentiles are capable of great faith, greater even than the faith of Israel. And so to pull that out of her, he answered her in the way that the typical Jewish teacher would have answered a Gentile woman at the time. I can't take what God has for the children and give it to the dogs. So she sets herself down with the dogs and says, well, even the dogs eat the crumbs off the children's table. And that illustrates a type of faith and trust in Christ that the rabbis back in Israel didn't have.
They didn't have, that's the thing. If you, if you think that you're coming into the text and you're more than worthy of the crumbs under the table, what are you saying about yourself?
What we say so we say every Sunday that we're not worthy to gather the crumbs under your table, but you're the same Lord whose property is always to have mercy.
I mean, what are we supposed to say? We are
worthy.
You better give
us a place at the table. And that's how that story is used.
We all deserve a place at the table. Right. No, none of us deserve a place at the table. It's not how any of this works. We should only do one more little section.
Should we do one more section? Because that'll take us over an hour, I'm sure. We're at 52 minutes right now, and we'll do...
All right, but we have to mark on here where we are. Okay,
we are at minute 5 minute 29 second mark.
I'll write that down here, 5 minute 29 seconds. I mean...
So we only have an hour left to go in this thing.
Are we going to do the whole thing?
Yeah, well, see, this gives people looking for fodder to podcast about, so... Think of this as the Mars Hill podcast,
with all the music and everything.
Yeah, in which we deconstruct the deconstructors.
Yeah, it's going to be so great. I mean, I am really discouraged, but you're right. We should use this as our Thanksgiving present.
Yeah.
To the world, we're offering up something to our listener to be grateful about, is that we're going to go through this line by line by line. So, anything else? Any part words?
No, I think remember to brine your turkey. That's when the one cooking tip.
Thaw it first. Then brine it.
That's you put it in a mixture of salt water and other, I'd add other spices too. But the salt is the essential thing. I think it's 1 tablespoon per cup, but check me on that. But the ratio is out there, get the ratio. Put it in that sucker for 12 hours at least, and then by the time, and then wash it off, and that will guarantee that you won't have a dry turkey. As long as you cook it, don't leave your turkey in until the internal temperature reaches 165, like the FDA says. Don't do that. Take it out, and the internal temperature in the breast reads 150, maybe. That's still pushing a little bit. And be sure to cover the breast, just the breast, with tin foil, like a little breastplate, until the temperature gets to be about 130, maybe, or 120, and then take the breastplate off, because what that'll do is that'll ensure even cooking between the dark meat and the white meat, because the dark meat takes longer to cook. So there you go. You'll have a...
Well, have a really happy Thanksgiving, and we'll probably be back next week. Thanks for listening.